An introduction to Henry Mayhew's London Labour and the London Poor. Henry Mayhew, born in 1812, was one of 17 children, all of whom were involved in some way or other in the world of journalism. Their father was a lawyer, and Henry himself tried the profession, but found himself unsuited to it. He turned to journalism at a time when there was a burgeoning market for new magazines. He wrote articles for and edited one such, Figaro in London. But competition was strong, and Mayhew went bankrupt, being forced to flee his debtors and settle in Paris. Here he met, in a similar position to himself, William Makepeace Thackeray and Douglas Jerrold, and they became lifelong friends. On his return from Paris, undaunted, Mayhew co-founded, in 1841, a new satirical magazine, which he called Punch. Jerrold and Thackeray became regular contributors. The magazine, which in the early days was sharply satirical, with a biting sense of humour, caught the spirit of the age of the Chartists and European political unrest, and soon was selling 6,000 copies a week. It continued to be published until 2002. By 1845, however, Mayhew had severed his connection with Punch and was writing once again as a freelance. Like Dickens, who was born in the same year as Mayhew, he had a social conscience and wished, in his journalism, to expose the injustices of British society and reveal the appalling poverty that existed in what, at the time, was the richest city in the world, London. At times, his descriptive passages are very reminiscent of Dickens, as he describes the clothes of the poor and their homes. Mayhew was anxious to show that honest workers endeavoured to have a regular, decent life, creating as far as possible the comforts of a home, however basic their income was, as in his report on the Irish immigrants. In all the houses that I entered were traces of household care and neatness that I had little expected to have seen. The cupboard, fastened in the corner of the room and stocked with mugs and cups, the mantelpiece with its images, and the walls covered with showy coloured prints of saints and martyrs, gave an air of comfort that strangely disagreed with the reports of the cabins in old Ireland. As the doors to the houses were nearly all of them kept open, I could, even whilst walking along, gain some notion of the furniture of the homes. In one house that I visited, there was a family of 5 persons living on the ground floor and occupying 2 rooms. The boards were strewn with red sand, and the front apartment had 3 beds in it, with the printed curtains drawn closely round. In a dark room at the back lived the family itself. It was fitted up as a parlour, and crowded to excess with chairs and tables, the very staircase having pictures fastened against the wooden partition. The fire, although it was midday and a warm autumn morning, served as much for light as for heat, and round it crouched the mother, children, and visitors, bending over the flame as if in the severest winter time. In a room above this were a man and woman lately arrived in England. The woman sat huddled up in a corner, smoking, with the husband standing over her in what appeared at first a menacing attitude. I was informed, however, that they were only planning for the future. This room was perfectly empty of furniture, and the once whitewashed walls were black, excepting the little square patches which showed where the pictures of the former tenants had hung. In another room I found a home so small and full of furniture that it was almost a curiosity for domestic management. The bed, with its chintz curtains looped up, filled one end of the apartment, but the mattress of it served as a long bench for the visitors to sit on. The table was so large that it divided the room in two, and if there was one picture, there must have been 30, all of holy men, with yellow glories round their heads. The window ledge was dressed out with crockery, and in a tumbler were placed the beads. The old dame herself was as curious as her room. Her shawl was fastened over her large frilled cap. She had a little button of a nose, with the nostrils entering her face like bullet holes. She wore over her gown an old pilot coat, well stained with fish slime, and her petticoats being short, she had very much the appearance of a Dutch fisherman or stage smuggler. His own bankruptcy may well have provided the empathy he felt for the poor. He began to interview the working classes of London in all their varied and colourful occupations. No job was beneath his consideration, and from the outset he was intent on presenting a detailed analysis of their wages, living conditions, family life, and the skills unique to their job. I shall consider the whole of the metropolitan poor under three separate phases. According as they will work, they can't work, and they won't work. He ran the gamut from street cleaners, street entertainers, workers in sweatshops, market traders, even mudlarks, children who searched the banks of the Thames for anything that they could sell for a few pence. The lad of whom I speak was discovered by me now nearly 2 years ago, mudlarking on the banks of the river near the docks. He was a quick, intelligent little fellow, and had been at the business, he told me, about 3 years. He had taken to mudlarking, he said, because his clothes were too bad for him to look for anything better. He worked every day with 20 or 30 boys, who might all be seen at daybreak with their trousers tucked up, groping about, and picking out the pieces of coal from the mud on the banks of the Thames. He went into the river up to his knees, and in searching the mud he often ran pieces of glass and long nails into his feet. When this was the case, he went home and dressed the wounds, but returned to the riverside directly. "For should the tide come up," he added, "without my having found something, why, I must starve till next low tide." In the very cold weather, he and his other shoeless companions used to stand in the hot water that ran down the riverside from some of the steam factories to warm their frozen feet. As soon as they were able, children were frequently sent out onto the streets to earn what they could for the family, or, if orphans, had to fend for themselves, like the orphan flower girls. The elder girl said, in an English accent, not at all garrulously, but merely in answer to my questions, "I sell flowers, sir. We live almost on flowers when they are to be got. I sell, and so does my sister, all kinds, but it's very little use offering anything that's not sweet. I think it's the sweetness as sells them. I sell primroses when they're in, and violets, and wallflowers and stocks and roses of different sorts and pinks and carnations and mixed flowers and lilies of the valley and green lavender and mignonette, but that I do very seldom, and violets again at this time of the year, for we get them both in spring and winter." They are forced in hothouses for winter sale, I may remark. "The best sale of all is, I think, moss roses, young moss roses. We do best of all on them. Primroses are good, for people say, 'Well, here's spring again,' to a certainty. Gentlemen are our best customers. I've heard that they buy flowers to give to the ladies. Ladies have sometimes said, 'A penny, my poor girl, here's 3 halfpence for the bunch.' Or they've given me the price of 2 bunches for one. So have gentlemen. I never had a rude word said to me by a gentleman in my life. No, sir, neither lady nor gentleman ever gave me 6 pence for a bunch of flowers. I never had a 6 pence given to me in my life. Never." It was a richly characterised underworld, largely ignored or unknown by the majority of the London population. Many of the occupations have long since ceased to be, either becoming redundant activities or replaced by the increase of machines that could do the job more efficiently. Jobs like the pure finders, who picked up dog feces from the street to sell to tanners who rubbed it into their leather to help preserve it. Every interview is a snapshot of a moment from the 1850s. Here is a typical Victorian market scene. The pavement and the road are crowded with purchasers and street sellers. The housewife, in her thick shawl, with the market basket on her arm, walks slowly on, stopping now to look at the stall of caps, and now to cheapen a bunch of greens. Little boys, holding three or four onions in their hand, creep between the people, wriggling their way through every interstice, and asking for custom in whining tones, as if seeking charity. Then the tumult of the thousand different cries of the eager dealers, all shouting at the top of their voices at one and the same time, is almost bewildering. "Sold again!" roars one. "Chestnuts all hot, a penny a score!" bawls another. "An halfpenny a skin, blacking!" squeaks a boy. "Buy, buy, 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 buy!" cries the butcher. "Half quire of paper for a penny," bellows the street stationer. "An halfpenny a lot, ingans."
"Tuppence a pound, grapes."
"Three a penny, Yarmouth bloaters."
"Who'll buy a bonnet for fourpence?"
"Pick 'em out cheap here. 3 pairs for halfpenny bootlaces." "Now's your time, beautiful whelks. A penny a lot." "Here's ha'porths," shouts the perambulating confectioner.
"Come and look at 'em. Here's toasters,"
bellows one with a Yarmouth bloater stuck on a toasting fork.
"Penny a lot, fine russets,"
calls the apple woman. And so the Babel goes on. Despite the passage of 170 years, we can recognise in modern London the descendants of the vagabond poor, like the homeless house painter.
"I often had to walk the streets all night. I was so perished I could hardly move my limbs. I never asked charity. I can't. But I could have eaten anything. I longed for the fried fish or so. Yes, I was ravenous for that, and such like, though I couldn't have touched it when I had money and was middling well off. Things are so different in the country that I couldn't fancy such meat. I was brought to that pitch. I had the greatest mind to steal something to get into prison, where, at any rate, I said to myself, I shall have some food and shelter. I didn't. I thought better of it. I hope something might turn up next day. Besides, it might have got into the papers, and my friends might have seen it, and I should have felt I disgraced them. Not that they would think so, because they couldn't know my temptations and my sufferings. When out all night, I used to get shelter, if I could, about Ungerford Market, among the straw. The cold made me almost dead with sleep, and when obliged to move, I couldn't walk at first. I could only crawl along. One night I had a penny given me, all I had gotten in 5 bitter nights in the streets. For that penny, I got 1/2 pint of coffee. It made me sick. My stomach was so weak. On Tuesday, I asked a policeman if he couldn't recommend me to some workhouse, and he told me to come here. And I was admitted, and was very thankful to get under shelter.
At the core of London labour and London poor, Mayhew has a mission: to understand and account for the discrepancy between the number of unemployed working people in relation to the amount of work available. Is it the increase in the working class population, as espoused by some political economists of the time, or is it the exploitation of the working classes by unscrupulous employers who seek to make their labourers work harder, working longer hours, for the same pay, thus cutting out the potential for another worker to share the employment? By tables and statistics, Mayhew labours to find the solution, but inevitably fails to come up with a viable alternative and fair method of employment. London labour was aimed at the comfortable middle classes and was an attempt to wake them up to the appalling plight of thousands of their fellow Londoners, of whom they never thought. I say thus much because I am anxious to make others feel, as I do myself, that we are the culpable parties in these matters. That they, poor things, should do as they do is but human nature, but that we should allow them to remain thus destitute of every blessing vouchsafed to ourselves, that we should willingly share what we enjoy with our brethren at the Antipodes, and yet leave those who are nearer, and who therefore should be dearer to us, to want even the commonest moral necessaries, is a paradox that gives to the zeal of our Christianity a strong savour of the chicanery of Kant. His researches did not produce any concrete changes in the labour market, but he was writing at a time of great social upheaval, with movements like the Chartists advocating reform of the voting system to give the working man a fairer representation, and was on the cusp of the foundation of the first trade unions. The revolutionary theories of Karl Marx had been published in London in 1848 in his Communist Manifesto, and Mayhew too, though he declared he wasn't a socialist, communist, Chartist or protectionist, but a simple gatherer of facts, must nevertheless be included as a radical thinker who had an influence on his times.